Nearly home. Isn't home where we all want to be? Reba here for Realtor.com, the pro's number one most trusted app. A dream home isn't a dream home if it comes with a nightmare commute. That's why Realtor.com has Real Commute, so you can search by drive time. Download the Realtor.com app today, cause you're nearly home. Make it real with Realtor.com.
Pro's number one most trusted app, based on August 2024 proprietary survey.
Welcome to Tech News Briefing. It's Tuesday, October 21st. I'm Belle Lynn for The Wall Street Journal. Scammers are stealing credit card credentials through text messages. We look at how a vast criminal operation has nabbed more than $1 billion. Plus, Oracle's stock jumped when the company reported nearly $500 billion in contracted future revenue. But will it all come through? Our Heard on the Street columnist digs into Oracle's finances. But first, you've probably gotten a text message before that seems a little fishy, and chances are it is. WSJ reporter Robert McMillan has been following the criminal enterprises behind those texts. He spoke with our Julie Chang about why they're so effective and what to look out for.
Bob, I'm sure many of us have gotten these text messages. I can probably pull up several on my phone right now. So can you walk us through here? What happens if I tap the link on one of those messages?
Oh, yeah, never do that. If you do that, then you're going to go to what's called a phishing site, which is basically a fake website. So if you click on one of these messages in San Francisco, it might be a fast track message. You'll go to a website that looks like a fast track website. You'll see an interface that allows you to pay some kind of minor fine on the site. And if you do that, you're basically handing over your credit card credentials to Chinese organized crime.
Okay, break that down a bit for us. What exactly is happening behind the scenes here?
Well, they're stealing your credit card credentials, but there's going to be like a weird thing that happens when you, quote, pay your fast track fee. There's going to be a point where it asks you for a passcode from your bank. Now, normally when you're shopping online or paying something with a credit card, that doesn't happen. But there's a really specific reason why that's happening. And basically, the criminals are not trying to charge you a minor charge for what appears to be a fast track violation. They're trying to put your credit card number into an Apple wallet in China. And I've seen demos of this software, and it's really amazing. The software shows the criminal as you're typing the numbers in. The criminal can see that each number going into the website. They can see all the digits of your credit card. And then what happens is on their end, they have software that converts those credit card numbers and expiration dates into an image of a credit card in front of them. And then they just scan that with the phone and it puts it into the phone's wallet. Now, when you do that, there is one step where you have to enter like a special 3-digit code from your bank. And so they're just waiting for you to enter that same code on the fake website. They add it on their Apple wallet and suddenly their card is in their phone.
In your story, you mentioned so-called SIM farms. Can you tell us what they are and how they factor into the scam?
They got to pump out all the spam, right? And the best way to do that, it turns out, is to have a weird little server box installed on a mobile network, like a could be Verizon or AT&T, that's just jammed full with what are those little white cards you get when you get a new phone, SIM cards. And so each one of those cards represents a phone number. And they've actually built boxes that can just jam like 36 of those cards like into one server with a bunch of little antennas. So to the mobile carrier, it looks like 36 individual telephones. But for the spammers, they can connect to these boxes from China and send out just 1,000 text messages an hour. They're all over the country. I talked to one person at a large telco who said they've seen them in 49 out of 50 states. Sometimes people will rent rooms and just fill them with these SIM boxes. The Secret Service busted a bunch of them in New York recently. That was kind of a big story.
So just to clarify, the SIM farms are here in the US, but they're being operated by criminals in China.
Yeah.
Okay, do you have any advice for our listeners on how to avoid these scams?
Anytime you're like on the internet doing something that you didn't expect to be doing with a sense of urgency, stop. Take a breath. And just use Google. Just go onto your personal computer and check your account, see what's going on. Don't trust your phone. That's my advice for just overall, like, to if you want to avoid these kind of scams.
That was WSJ reporter Bob McMillan speaking with our producer, Julie Chang. Coming up, Oracle could be poised to be a big winner of the AI boom, but the full picture of its finances hasn't come into view yet. We'll dig into it after the break.
Boardrooms love buzzwords. AI, climate, resilience.
But what do they actually mean for CFOs and execs trying to survive the next earnings call?
That's where the pre-read comes in.
Real experts and real talk.
Subscribe to the pre-read, presented by Workiva.
Oracle is a nearly 50-year-old company that's known for making databases, the kind of technology that seems more fit for corporate busy work than the next generation of tech. But the company's emerged in the last few years as a real contender in helping put together the building blocks of the new AI era, building data centers and buying up advanced AI chips to support it. Yet, it hasn't all been smooth sailing. Oracle faces real questions over how it'll finance its AI infrastructure build-out. WSJ Heard on the Street columnist Dan Gallagher joins us to discuss what's going on. So, Dan, a goal of Oracle's Financial Analyst Day last week was to answer some of the questions that analysts and investors have been asking about how they're going to backstop and support all of this AI infrastructure build-out. And there were also a lot of questions around the profitability of AI infrastructure overall. What do you think was the goal of Oracle's Investor Day?
They obviously wanted to put more meat on the bone, essentially, to help people understand. And so what happened is they gave even better growth numbers than they did in their call a month ago, because they said in the last 30 days they've had even more business come in. And they gave some breakdowns of the gross margins of various parts of their business. There were some reports a couple weeks ago about how the AI business, the margins are really, really low. And they were trying to make the point that, yes, they're low at the first because they get new chips in. All the expenses are front-loaded, but they don't have full revenue coming in yet from that. And so they tried to give more color on that. The thing they did not do was give a sense of, like, what's going to happen spending-wise, how much they're going to have to spend, and what that's going to mean for the company's debt load. Are they going to sell more stock, have to raise a lot more debt? Because based on what they've projected for the revenue they have to service, they have to spend a lot because they have to light up a lot more data centers and a lot more capacity to power that revenue. So they left a few key questions unanswered, even though they did give more details about the growth they're seeing.
So even with those unanswered questions, what was your overall impression of whether investors and analysts were sort of assuaged by what Oracle presented that day?
A lot of the analysts are very positive on Oracle because they see the growth numbers they're giving. And Oracle historically has been pretty conservatively managed. They're not typically been a company to, like, make outlandish claims and not make them. And so there's essentially a lot of faith in Wall Street that what the company is saying they can make happen. And they also have a very strong operating history of being very profitable. And so that's why some of these reports that they were almost giving away their AI business for free doesn't quite square up with how the company is long operated. But investors are starting to ask some harder questions now, because we've seen over the past month or so all these press releases from OpenAI, from NVIDIA, from AMD, from all these companies about these outlandish, huge numbers coming. And people are starting to say, well, wait, what's going to have to be spent to do that?
Speaking of OpenAI, we know that Oracle has a $300 billion deal with OpenAI, which boosted its contracted future revenue by a great deal. What is the risk of depending on OpenAI so hugely as a customer?
Because if OpenAI is going to actually pay that kind of revenue, OpenAI has to get a lot bigger than it is now. I mean, OpenAI right now is, according to reports, it's a privately held company, but reports are that it's going to generate around $13 billion a year in revenue, at least this year. Sounds big. That's actually in the bottom half of the S&P 500. That's not even close to enough revenue to meet the obligations that have been implied by all these contracts they've been signing, not just with Oracle, but with NVIDIA, AMD, and everything. So there's a lot of hope hinged on this one company becoming much more massive. And then because Oracle is spending so much and is expected to actually burn cash over the next 3 years, which is something they've not done in the operating history that I've been able to find ever, it's their biggest bet ever.
And along the lines of this being such a big bet for them, there are so many questions swirling over the fact that we may be in an AI bubble. And when I spoke to the new co-CEOs and new dual CEOs of Oracle, they really weren't concerned. They really pointed to this idea that demand is far outstripping supply right now. And so providers like Oracle, and pointing to a sort of bigger industry problem, are coming in to fill that gap. And when there's demand, the supply will come and then the revenue will follow over the long term. So what's your take? Are we in a bubble? And if so, what's the risk to Oracle if we are in such a bubble?
Yeah, there's a bubble going on. The bigger question is like who gets impacted by it, where it gets seen. Is this purely an investment valuation bubble or an actual business bubble? There's a lot of differences between now and the dot-com era. People are reducing this to like some more simplistic notions than really fits. With Oracle, again, comes back to the fact that they are pretty closely hinged to this one customer getting really big. The difference with the dot-com bubble is you had lots of fiber going in the ground that wasn't actually used. There's not a single GPU cluster that is not being used. Every time they get it in and installed, it's lit up. Not just Oracle, but its cloud competitors. So they're legitimately seeing a lot of demand from that side. But the customers that are paying for that, eventually needing to start generating their own revenue with their own AI services, and that's still a question remaining to be answered, is like how much revenue is going to happen in the next few years? Are they going to be able to monetize them in a quick and rapid way, or is it going to be more of a slow burn thing? And right now, stocks are priced for this happening very rapidly. And if it happens, but happens more slowly, then that's when you'll see the effects of like, is this a bubble that's going to burst or whatever?
That was WSJ Heard on the Street columnist Dan Gallagher. And that's it for Tech News Briefing. Today's show was produced by Julie Chang with deputy editor Chris Sinsley. Logging off, I'm Belle Lin for The Wall Street Journal. We'll be back later this morning with TNB Tech Minute. Thanks for listening.